Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Deconstructive Criticism. My name is Aaron Flam, and our guest today is Michael Soussan. He is the author of Backstabbing for Beginners, My Crash Course in International Diplomacy. Michael Soussan is a writer, but was a program coordinator for the United Nations Iraq program. That job became a stepping stone to becoming a whistleblower in what PBS NewsHour called the largest financial scandal in UN history. But first, I want to thank you who supports Deconstructive Criticism. Thank you for supporting me on Patreon via PayPal, Bitcoin, or Swish 0768-943737. 0768-943737. All ways to contribute can be found in the description of this episode, regardless of what platform you're listening on. You will also find a link to my webpage, aaronflam.com, where you can buy t-shirts, mugs, and hoodies with this podcast's motto, among other things, "Your feelings are hurting my thoughts," as well as my own book, "This is a Swedish Tiger." Second edition is now sold out. The third edition will be going to print next week, and when it comes out, it will contain three new chapters. Thanks to you who bought a copy of the first and or second edition, /S. Your support enables me to, for instance, fly to Los Angeles to conduct the series of interviews you can now listen to on Deconstructive Criticism's feed. Among them, the interview you're about to listen to now with Michael Soussan. I wish I had read his book, Backstabbing for Beginners, before I wrote my own, because they are eerily similar in many respects. Our discussion will concentrate on Michael's book, Backstabbing for Beginners, has also been made into a film, but I've only read the book and can warmly recommend it, especially if you want to learn more about international relations. As the title of the book clearly states, it's a crash course. The book describes Michael Soussan's experiences within UN's Oil for Food program and the corruption within that organization. Michael Soussan started at the UN in his early 20s, and maybe there's something about Michael, because the reason he applied for a job at the UN in the first place was because he was tired of working for the private sector and thereby contributing to the destruction of the world. In short, he was driven by idealism. It is also a book about cultures of silence and that which enables them. Conformism, consensus seeking, and conflict avoidance. Conflict avoidance is really just a nicer way of saying cowardice, because it always seems to come off as passive aggression. I know, because I've talked about these characteristics in relation to Swedish culture in my entire career as a stand-up comedian living in Sweden. The flip side of Swedish culture is that it is also very idealistic. Take it from someone living in the country calling itself a moral superpower. This was one of the two main reasons for me wanting to talk to Michael. These traits are truly dominant in Swedish culture. For me, they are closely connected to egalitarian collectivism of that particularly Swedish brand of social democracy. But having grown up in Sweden, I have known few others. These traits are probably universal, and culture and or ideology might reinforce or weaken them. The other reason for my interest is that consensus in Sweden dictates a doctrine of uncritical adulation for the United Nations. Sweden's got UN fever. To question the UN in Sweden is taboo. If Swedes today had only known that when the UN was founded, then Social Democratic Prime Minister Per Albin Hansson, one of modern Sweden's founding fathers, was dead set against joining. He wanted instead to see an international organization for social democratic parties. That idea became what is known today as the Socialist International, but Sweden is ruled by PC, or as we call it here, consensus culture. Any history that doesn't fit the current narrative is conveniently swept under the rug and quickly forgotten. As against the UN, as Per Albin Hansson was, then, as completely for the UN, Swedes are today. Our elected leaders shower the UN and its operation with funds collected from Swedish taxpayers' money. Most of the time, more in the hope of securing a future job at the UN for themselves than to improve the world, it seems. I won't mention any names, but Margot Wallström is definitely one of the names I'm not mentioning. When all other donors withdrew funds from UNVRA just the other year because of corruption within that UN institution, she instead increased funding. Now she's retired from being the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Sweden and instead has a cushy job at the UN. Today, Michael Susan is a writer living in Los Angeles, where this interview was recorded. The conversation, as well as the book, was useful reminders to myself to avoid tribalism and collectivism of any sort. In the end, it is up to, or comes down, to you. And I hope this conversation serves as a reminder to all that idealism can often render worse results than a little cynicism. With that little nugget, it is my pleasure to present Michael Susan. Enjoy. So, welcome to Deconstructive Criticism, Mr. Michael Susan.
Thank you.
I usually start out with a very broad question, so that you get to define yourself before I delve into the piece of work you presented me with. So, who are you, in your own words?
A Sephardic Viking, whose big aspiration when he was 8 years old was to become a clown. And my father was not very happy about that, and he said I should be an international lawyer. And then I tried to become one, but I've landed in a firm that was extremely corrupt. It was run by a person called Jack Abramoff, who ended up on the cover of Time magazine as the man who bought Washington. So after 9 months of seeing that at work, I got a job at the UN, which I thought would be a chance to do some good.
And sort of wash your soul clean.
Yeah, maybe. But also, you know, it was interesting. You get to see the world and some parts that you would otherwise not go to. And this huge humanitarian program was starting, which would use more money than the UN had ever seen.
Which program was this?
This was the Oil for Food program, which was necessary during the time between the two wars. The Iraqi people were slammed with sanctions, and they had a destroyed economy, and Saddam was still in power. And the sanctions would continue as long as Saddam was in power. So essentially, they invented this system whereby we would let Iraq sell oil, because the oil market was happy to have the supply, and then take the money into a UN account and use it exclusively for humanitarian purposes. So our job at the UN was to oversee the use of this money.
And this was because George Bush the Elder,
mm-hmm.
he went into Iraq.
Yeah.
And this was Operation Desert Storm, right?
Yeah.
And then the US and Britain wanted to impose sanctions on Iraq.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but they didn't really affect Saddam. He could continue to live in luxury, sort of?
Up to a point, but fundamentally, oil needs to flow for Iraq to be manageable at all, because they have no other resources.
But it was really hard on the population.
Yeah, extremely hard. I mean, we saw people on their deathbed, you know, in hospitals. We really saw the conditions there. I traveled with the Undersecretary General in charge of the whole operation. So we're looking at a $73 billion operation.
And you were very young when you got this job.
I was very young, but there's a thing at the UN, which is that people don't trust the person right underneath them. So the Undersecretary General did not trust his Swedish director. And so he took the assistant of his director with him to Iraq, both as a slight to his director, and because he knew that there was a higher chance of a young, you know, green apple not creating any problems for him.
And also you had just come from Jack Abramov's firm.
And I could write.
Yes.
And at the UN, there's very few people who can actually do that. So that was, you know, when you're meeting with the vice president, who at the time was running this program, the foreign minister and all these guys.
Iraqi foreign minister.
Iraqi foreign minister and so on. He needed someone to take his notes and write the memos back, essentially.
I just want to jump back, because you said Sephardic Viking, but you didn't provide any explanation. Would you care to elaborate?
Yes. Well, while I was living in New York, I kept being asked at cocktail parties, so what are you? Where are you from? And there's an accent I detect, and where is it from? And I never knew quite what to say, because I'm half Danish from my mother's side. Straight Vikings, no, you know, nothing else to say there. And from my father's side, they were a family that was born in, my father was born in Morocco at a time when the family was trying to flee during World War II. All of their ships, they were merchant shippers, had been seized by the Vichy regime, and they were planning to take a boat to America.
Because Morocco was French at this point in time.
It was French, but you could still bribe your way around, like the police, as in the movie,
yes.
was very bribeable. And so we were not...
And the movie you're referring to is Casablanca.
No? Yeah. Like in the movie. So essentially, he grew up in Casablanca itself. And he then left for Israel, as so many Jews in the Middle East had to do at the time. And there he met my mom, who was on a tour in a kibbutz in the 60s, you know,
yeah.
Hippies. And
the worst kind of people.
Most dangerous kind of people on earth. After the war, he decided to get out of there and move to Denmark. And there I came.
All right. And which war was this? Because the Vichy regime, they were the French Nazi collaborators,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And they... took all the money from the Jews of Morocco, and that's why your father had to flee. But the war you're referring to now is the 67 war in Israel.
They were in a state of permanent warfare between 56 and 57, which is trench warfare in essence, with both Jordan, Syria, and Egypt. So 67 was just the war that kind of like stop this situation of perpetual retribution cycle. So he went back for 67, unknown to us. We thought he was on vacation, but I was too little at the time. I mean, I wasn't even born in 67. There was the 73 war,
I remember,
of course, as well, and I was born in 73.
All right. But your father went back for the 67 war.
I'm not. My father has a complicated history.
All right.
Which I don't know all the parts of.
So you're a Sephardic Viking, and then he wanted you to be a lawyer instead of a clown. Good on him. because I wanted to be in finance, and now I'm a clown.
There you go.
so how did you end up in the United States?
Well, I think the dream of the family was always to go to the U.S. They were saving up to go to the U.S. when my father was little. But then the Americans landed on the beaches in Casablanca very early in the war, in fact, 42 or 43. And the first house to be bombed on the hill of Casablanca was my grandfather's house. And there was nobody there, but still, it was... They were very welcome, of course, by the French and by the Jewish community among the French. But they never ended up being able to go to America because my grandmother died in childbirth. So essentially, my grandfather was left with five children alone and didn't want to remarry. So it limited him a lot in what the mobility we had. And also, I think, our family was based in they were in the Navy, and we think we lost the person they were in contact with at Pearl Harbor. So essentially, we didn't have a family to go to anymore. So one by one, they left for Israel. My father was the first at age 14 to go. But it has to be said for Morocco that of all the countries that were... You know, that fell victim to this type of Arab nationalism that was, in fact, a kind of extremism at the time. Morocco was the least brutal towards the Jews. They mainly wanted independence from France. And the king himself surrounds himself with Jewish advisors and has been for years. So there are some privileged Jews that were able to stay.
Yes, but some very privileged.
Very privileged.
Yes.
The middle class and anybody under, they kind of had to go.
Yes. But also, I mean, this was during the Second World War.
And after, I mean, in the 50s, that's when the independence movement started. And in a sense, there is this belief in the West that the Arab world hates the West because of Israel. What they don't understand is that from their perspective, Israel is a Western bastion in their, in what they consider their turf. And they don't hate the West because of Israel. They hate Israel because they see them as Western. Their ideology is based on anti-Westernism, basically.
Yes.
The West corrupted us. That is the essence of just about every... I think extremist movement, from the religious ones to the non-religious ones, there is this narrative, I think, that we find in a lot of... Hitler used the same narrative, which is there used to be this golden age in which we were smart and rich and everything was great. And these others took it away from us. And if we just eliminate these others, then we shall again be great. And of course, it's very easy to galvanize people's hatred against a minority group, be they Jews in Europe or Yazidis in Syria and Iraq. It's a very powerful mobilization tool.
And much easier than actually building a modern civilization.
Yeah, much easier. And also, they benefit from the fact that we did... have a role as the Western world did have a role in corrupting these regimes, these military regimes that were...
Well, they came into being after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they were bankrolled, in essence, by Western powers that would get kickbacks from what they sent in. So... They're not entirely wrong. Boko Haram, for example, means West bad, right? Boko
Haram. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
is that what it means?
That's what I was told. And
they're very literal. That's a very literal movement.
Yeah, yeah. And ISIS, whenever people come in, they're indoctrinated into this system, sometimes online before they come. But in essence, there is this dream of a great Islam that once was extremely... powerful and self-sufficient. And they are correct. There was a time under the leadership of Saladin when Islam was, in fact, the Arabic Islam was, in fact, the most advanced part of the world. Saladin took residence in Alexandria in Egypt. What they don't say is that Saladin was a Kurd, and that his senior advisors were Jewish, and one of which was Maimonides, who was the person who was perhaps one of the most prestigious writers of mystic Judaic thought. So, yes, there was a time when the Arab world was at its height, but it was not when they invaded people, you know, with the sword, with black flags. It was when Saladin was in power and able to lead that world.
And he moved to Alexandria, because that's also a place of learning.
Yeah. Yeah, Alexandria was the Greeks and the Romans, you know, and eventually the Persians at some time, the greatest, I mean, they had the library there, the resources, the intellectual resources.
Have you been?
No, I haven't been, but it's on my list.
It will take a while. Egypt is not a place to go to at the moment, I think. I was there just a few years ago. It was a very paranoid Stimmung.
Yeah.
Which I know sounds like a sort of a synth band from Germany, but yeah.
Yeah. No, you can go in. I mean, as a person who's been a bit of a war correspondent, there is a way in. Alexandria is a place where you can get fixers and you can get pretty safely around. Cairo.
But anyway, you grew up in Denmark.
I grew up in France.
Oh, really?
Because when I was four, we moved to France, where my parents worked as foreign correspondents. They were both journalists. And my father's second piece of advice, because he was a writer and also a writer of books, was to not become a writer. But when I was done with the UN, when I became a whistleblower at the UN, then all of these communication jobs at large companies were no longer open to someone who had been in the news as a whistleblower.
Yeah, you don't want to hire a blabbermouth.
No.
Not at a PR firm.
No.
No.
The job of a spokesman is to shut up.
Yes.
And so essentially I ended up writing because I was back to the wall and I had to make my make a living somehow. So the writing I would do for these communication professionals would be through PR firms or as a ghostwriter, as a hired gun, essentially.
So you grew up in France, mm-hmm. Then you went to college in France?
Then I went to college in the United States.
All right, at what college?
So, no, I went to Brown on the East Coast.
That's quite a prestigious college.
It is.
And it is even a university.
It is, and they call it college just because once you've studied 4 years, then you get your master's, and I don't know. I don't know that they know the difference between a university and a college, frankly. But
one gets to appoint professors.
Wouldn't it be nice?
Well, at least that's the case in Sweden. Högskola,
really?
Which would be loosely translated to college, they can't give that type of tenure. That is, you know, guaranteed for the rest of your life, basically, while universities can. And I haven't found much else that differs between the two concepts.
Interesting.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
Wow. No, it's been a life where I went back to France for a master's because the prices in the United States are crazy. And then came back and got this, was able to get these various jobs at a law firm and then at the UN and so on.
How old were you when you came into the UN?
I was 24, but it was very, very unusual. Essentially, what happened was that they had no idea how to deal with Washington. There was a great deal of mistrust in Washington towards the UN in general, but also towards this program. And they needed someone who could speak Washingtonian, in essence, tell them what was going on, what senator to speak to, and what to expect. And at the same time, didn't have an American citizenship. So a Dane was perfect.
A French Sephardic Dane.
That part I didn't push in the interview.
No.
The Danish part was easier. And it was a little funny because in both Iraq and in France, people would know that my last name, Soussan, is Jewish. But at the UN, they didn't. It just sounds French, you know.
Yeah.
So I was the only person of my type of background working this operation. That's also a fact.
Mais tu parles français couramment, hein?
Oui, oui, absolument.
Okay.
J'ai grandi en
you
France.
Obviously do, and that's all the French I know.
Good one. You sound like you know. You sound like you speak it fluently. So
I'm great at faking. So you get into the UN and they need help with this program, and yeah. The UN's budget is dwarfed by the budget of the Oil for Food program.
Oh yeah, we had just for ourselves to pay ourselves, we had $2 billion, and the entire budget of the UN per year is $2 billion.
And what exactly was your job managing this? Not personally, but the job of the UN in managing this program. What did it entail?
Well, it entailed precisely what we failed to do. It entailed making sure that all of the money that was gained from the oil sales went to the people in need. And trust me, there were people in dire need. There was no electricity in hospitals. They couldn't operate. They didn't have painkillers. I mean, just as General Powell and the others preparing for the first Gulf War, they told Iraq in advance, and it was confirmed by the UN afterwards, that they would basically bomb them back to the pre-industrial age. And they did so. Before launching their forces into Kuwait, they bombed Iraq back to the pre-industrial age.
How do you do that? Are there special targets?
Yeah.
Or
yeah, you basically go in with a war plan that resembles a World War II war plan.
Total war,
and total air war at least. That basically means that you take out water and sanitation plants, which in a hot country like Iraq will engender the spread of waterborne diseases, which, as we know, kill most infants and babies that are given powdered milk, and affects the mothers, of course, what we would call the most vulnerable groups, and the minorities who were not given, you know, ration cards and etc. We tried to set up programs for them. So there was a lot of work, and the money was needed. And our job was simply to make sure that the money went to them, not to Saddam and his cronies, which we found out after the investigation happened, included 2,500 of our very well-known international corporations, who then paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fine to the US and French and other governments, none of which went back to Iraq, whose money they actually stole. I mean, it was their natural resources at the end of the day.
Yes. I'm just going to... how does the UN work, just for the average listener?
So I think we need to reframe the question as, how does the UN fail to work?
Yes.
First of all, because otherwise we cannot come up with an answer. And I think the way the UN fails to work as well as it should is because at the heart of it is an idea, which is to apply the democratic system of government to a global scale. Now, this idea is old. It dates back to Immanuel Kant when he wrote On Perpetual Peace. But without getting too intellectual, Wilson then based the League of Nations on that. And after World War II, they decided, okay, we need a new institution to govern international relations and have debates instead of wars. And that's all very good, but when you apply the democratic system to countries that are not themselves democratic, then you're basically saying, come and play bridge with us, but you don't need to play by the rules. So,
Because that's basically what Kant wanted in this Organization for Perpetual Peace. He wanted all the countries needed to be democratic in order to respect the rules of the game. And
that's exactly it. There's, you know, the democracy is the rules of the game, right? You respect the rules of the game. You respect your role in it, and you respect other parties. And he had a secret clause because he was not allowed to say something like this at the time without being hung, you know. His secret clause, which he would share only with people he trusted, was that until such a time We have to remember this is during the Napoleonic Wars. Until such a time as all member states or all states are democratic, the best we can hope for is an alliance of democracies that can, among themselves, not have war, between themselves and tyrannies stand together. So it was already, you know,
back in the
plane, two centuries ago. And essentially, we deluded ourselves because we needed Stalin to finish off a very, very powerful German army. And in the aftermath, when they divided up the world, they, in essence, tried to freeze it. And as we know, the world changes no matter what you try to do.
Yes. If nothing else, you can ask a former Yugoslavian.
Yeah. So when the world unfroze in the 90s, the UN found itself in a situation where we thought, at least I thought, okay, here's an opportunity. We were looking at walls were falling, democracy was spreading. Here is an opportunity to get more countries to play by the rules. And that was maybe a little bit naive, but trying...
I'm from Sweden, man. That's a national sport.
Naivete, yes. Yeah. Well, I'm from Denmark, so we're not far behind. Of course it didn't work. You know, Stalin would veto every resolution by the Americans in the Security Council, and the Americans would veto every resolution by the Soviets in the Security Council.
Because that's where decisions get made in the UN, right? The Security Council.
War and peace decisions, yeah.
Yes, and General Assembly? What is that for?
Well, some would argue that with the advent of the internet, they could all meet on Skype and talk for free.
Yes, well, they could.
But it is a chance for diplomats to listen to each other's official policies, which are stated on stage. And it's also a chance for diplomats to meet on the sidelines to discuss various issues they have with each other.
But to get back to why the UN does not work.
Yeah, so the reason it doesn't work is that some members don't play by the rules.
Because they're not democratic.
Because they're not democratic.
Would you include France?
Well, I haven't said that only tyrannies don't play by the rules.
Okay.
The fact that some countries naturally don't play by the rules has caused a certain cynicism to set in. The bureaucracy, which has, one could say, forced or encouraged democracies to then say, well, then we're not going to play by some rules either. We're going to go it alone when we want and use the UN when it serves us. So you mentioned Yugoslavia earlier. That was the first conflict that erupted after the end of the Cold War. Yugoslavia, which was Croatia, and which was held together by communistic centralism, fell apart. And at the time, I met a refugee from Srebrenica who told me, when you see the blue helmets coming, it means you're already fucked.
And he was from Srebrenica. He knew. Yes.
Because it was a French commander who had...
UN commander.
Who had tried to ring the headquarters in New York and ask for instructions. Should we use our guns to protect these refugees? And this was the night before they were separated into buses and all the men were mowed down. 8,000 men were mowed down, basically, by...
Bosnian men against Serbian forces.
Yes.
And the UN did nothing to stop.
And the UN did nothing.
Why is that?
Because when he rang the UN, there was nobody to answer. There was no crisis center established by the UN by the UN secretariat to be responsive. And the UN secretary general would not want to get his feet dirty by making such a decision as opening fire in defense of civilians. So if you can't open fire in defense of civilians, then what are peacekeepers for?
What are peacekeepers for? We all want to know now.
Well, the places where they're successful are the places where there is a peace to keep, like Cyprus. So these are very good missions where people are paid very good money to go to Cyprus, where we already have a status quo and a peace line between the Turks and the Greeks. And so the UN were sent there as peacekeepers. And one could say that this operation was, relatively speaking, a success, but it is also extremely corrupt, because it serves as a job provider for the well-connected people on the island. And it's misspent resources. We no longer need a large force of blue helmets and a huge bureaucracy in Cyprus. So the UN doesn't work because it's also, the second reason is that it's badly managed. The previous secretary general couldn't even speak, the one from Korea, couldn't even speak in a way that his own staff could understand.
Ban Ki-moon. And what do you mean? I mean, there must be one or two, I imagine, Korean translators at the UN who could translate the words of the secretary general.
And that's literally what they needed. He hired a lot of Koreans on the 38th floor, which is the floor in which the secretary general, the CEO of the UN, if you want,
he resides,
is based. Yeah. And so a lot of Koreans came and started giving people orders because they were the only ones who could translate them to these senior officials.
Why did he get the job, Ban Ki-moon? Had he gone through the long march through the UN from...
No. No, I
don't.
Where
did it come from?
Well, he came from the fact that the UN basically has a, it's not a law, but it's a system of choosing a person from each continent. So Africa had its turn with Boutros-Ghali, because technically Egypt is in Africa, if you don't count the other side of the Suez Canal. And this was Asia's turn. So who could agree on an Asian? It could certainly not be a Japanese, because the Chinese have a veto in the Security Council. And it certainly could not be a Chinese, because the Japanese would pressure the U.S. to say no, let's put it that way. And it couldn't be an Indian because of the Chinese-India. So basically, the person that becomes Secretary General is the person who has done the least to piss off any of the major powers, which basically means that they've done the least in general, but have calmly, in their own foreign ministry or at the World Bank, gone to meetings and kept their mouths shut. And little by little, you just go up the ladder until you...
Because you annoy no one.
It's
more important than impressing someone.
Yes. I mean, if we had a vote where the world could vote for the Secretary General, then it would be, a democratic institution that reflects the wishes of the world. And then people would have to present themselves and say, this is what I want to do with the UN. These are the priorities I see. And this is a platform I would like to implement, just like in a normal democracy, which we thought America was. But that's another story.
It's a federal republic. and it has an electoral system. And I guess a future UN election would have to have some sort of electoral system as well.
It would
otherwise
have to
be a Chinese secretary.
A federalism, yeah.
So I found it interesting because you also mentioned, I'm coming from Sweden, where one is quite used to it, but you write that you ended up in a strange conspiracy of silence.
Well, everybody knew. I mean, I would get a call every month from the oil traders, the journalists who report on what's going to be the price of Iraqi crude this month. And
that was figures, crude oil, and that was figures you needed in order to know how much food and medicine you could buy for the Iraqi people.
Yeah.
Yes.
But the price was set by the market, quote unquote, because Kirkuk Light is a form of oil that can be extracted from the ground in the same place that BP first found, British Petroleum first found oil. It's the cheapest, best quality oil in the world. So if you speak to an oil person, they start salivating, literally, when you talk about Kirkuk Light. So the oil trading, which is all based in Switzerland, they need to know what is the official price of Iraqi oil this month, because the official price was not the market price, okay? And everybody knew that.
At the UN?
Well, yes, and in the Security Council.
Yes, but not, you know, generally in the public.
No, because the press had no interest in presenting this story. It was so obvious. Everybody knew it. And the Iraqi people knew the system was gamed because the communities that Saddam Hussein liked the least got the worst rations, and the ones he favored the most, you know, they were fat. They literally had an obesity problem in some areas of Iraq during what was, you know, supposedly a famine. So if every member of the Security Council knows, that means, you know, the U.S. government under both Bush and Clinton knew that there was cheating going on. And essentially, they cheated by making the oil price artificially high and then splitting the returns between Iraq and oil traders, or artificially low, depending on how the market went, artificially low because oil is traded in futures. So they would set a price that they knew would pull the market one way or another.
It would always give them a cut.
Yeah.
And some of that money, or most of it, would go back to Saddam.
Yeah, it would go half of it would go back to Saddam, and half of it would, through diplomatic pouches, be either
filled with dollar bills.
Filled with dollar bills, be flown back to Iraq.
And then he could use that money as bribe money to international companies and international diplomats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And buy new police cars and buy new weaponry and buy whatever he needed to defend his regime, because his only interest was in getting the resources to stay in power and keep his cronies happy.
And who were the main culprits benefiting from this trade on the Security Council?
All of them.
All of them.
And I'm talking about a Security Council where we have 7 years of rotation.
So there are five permanent members?
There's five permanent members, all of whom profited from it. And then there were other members. This was a scandal where the Indian government basically was...
Deposed?
Deposed the South African government.
Didn't look too good for Australia?
No, didn't look too good for the Australian Wheat Board. I'm glad I paid for my own lunch when I sat down with them. Because their diplomats would basically lobby the UN for contracts, you know.
And the French?
The Minister of the Interior, Charles Pasqua, was accused of having been in on one of these oil deals. But basically everybody wanted in on this thing, and everybody knew about it.
And, but the Russians took extra... They took more than most.
The Russians took more than most, yeah.
But they sold also a lot of weapons to Saddam.
And then there's that. I don't have personally proof of that, but their weapons certainly weren't American made. But in America, there was one funny contract for the rebuilding of one of the oil fields. And suddenly you have Texaco, which had on its board one of the people who had become a very senior Bush administration official, and another, Halliburton was the other company, which basically is one of the biggest providers of services to the U.S. armed forces in times of peace and war, especially in times of war. I think Halliburton was Dick Cheney and Texaco was Condoleezza Rice. So these two people did business under the Oil for Food program with Saddam. I'm not saying these two people did the actual business, but they sat on the board of companies that knew what the deal was. And they complied with the 10%, you know, bribe. And we know that because the investigation ended up being so thorough that it showed it black on white. And they had to then pay huge fines to the U.S. government, because there's an anti-corruption law in the United States, which is completely unrealistic to comply with, because it basically means that you can't bribe people locally if you're doing business with dictatorships.
And if you're doing business with dictatorships,
you have to bribe locally.
Yeah.
There's just, it's,
That's the system.
That's the system. And in a way, it's the system everywhere, except here you have to hire lawyers.
Yeah, so we have institutionalized it, in
right.
a way.
Right, we've institutionalized it. But corruption is endemic and inherent to the system of governance. And so there's a lot of large companies, large companies that talk about transparency, that talk about governance, that talk about good governance, meaning that they have so much power that they need to be good members of our society. And in this scandal, we found proof that they were basically saying one thing and doing another. The proof came from a list that Saddam kept in handwritten notes about who bribed him and who he bribed. So this list contained the names of a lot of people, including, to my complete surprise, a word that sounded like the way they were pronouncing the boss of this undersecretary general of the UN that I traveled to Iraq with. And that I stood
that you called Pasha in the book.
That I called Pasha in the book, because everybody called him Pasha in reality also. And his name was Binan Sivan, and he was a commensurate a UN bureaucrat who had figured out how to play all sides. And they gave him the Oil for Food program not as a gift. Let's put it this way. It was more like a bureaucratic banana peel.
Because no one wants responsibility.
They all knew it was going to get dirty. You know, business with Saddam is going to get dirty. Oil business is going to get dirty.
So someone at the UN hoped this would get him fired at some point or another during the program, and they gave it to him.
Yes. Just like Kofi Annan was sent to...
And Kofi Annan was the Secretary General at the time.
Yes. But he himself had been sent to Yugoslavia by Butros Ghali, because Butros Ghali knew that Yugoslavia was a mess, and he was hoping that his main rival for Secretary General, he was hoping that he would make a mess of it down there. Instead, he made friends with the Americans down there, and then they supported his bid for Secretary General, and they wanted Butros Ghali stopped. There is a big story that we never proved, but we know that basically Saddam tried to bribe Butros Ghali to the tune of $1 million in a suitcase in order to make the rules of the program such that bribery could occur in it, because the original rules proposed by the British would not have allowed for any corruption to occur and would not have necessitated a whole bureaucracy of UN people to pretend there's no corruption, right? So once I realized that our real job was basically to sustain a lie.
Because you got reports all the time, right? From people in the field. And questions from companies who wanted in on the program. And you tried to tell your superiors about this.
We did. I mean, I protected all of my Swedish bosses who were, you know, director of program management for the largest and most corrupt enterprise in UN history. And because of the memos we sent up the chain of command, they were clean, super squeaky clean. They came out with no wrongdoing.
Because you had two Swedish directors.
I had two Swedish directors in a row.
Yes. And you told them, or they found out.
No, I told them, because I was the only continuous person who was there. I was basically teaching them the ropes when they came in as directors. Because my first director was Ethiopian. And when they realized that he was competent, they took him away from the old... which is very typical of bureaucracies in general, not just the UN.
And then they took in the Swedes, whom you protected, but aren't they competent or are they naive?
No, they tried. They tried to make it work. They even tried something that simple as putting anti-blast glass on our UN headquarters, because some of the bombings that had occurred, you know, the US would bomb once in a while for various reasons, non-compliance with the weapons inspectors or some other reason. And once they bombed the Iraqi building that housed all of their electronic security surveillance, which they had placed right next to the UN headquarters, precisely in order not to be bombed. But when the U.S. Sent a missile basically straight into the roof down and the whole building exploded from inside, when I arrived in Iraq, it still stood. But the bomb blast somehow had blasted the windows of our own cafeteria at the UN headquarters, which was basically headquartered at an old hotel. And for 3 years, one of my Swedish directors, no, for 2 years, he tried to get some protections, basic stuff, you know, that you do in a war zone. A film that protects glass against hurting people horribly if a bomb blast explodes. And in the end, after the war, when the problem was no longer Saddam Hussein, but became Al-Qaeda and its various affiliates, Al-Qaeda used a truck that was bought under the UN for Oil for Food program. They filled it with 1,000 pounds of explosives and drove it right under the window of Sergio Vieira de Mello, who was the man that I was actually supposed to go back and work for, and exploded our UN headquarters, killing 20 people and wounding 80 people. And the irony here is simply that I had made an enemy of a person who was the ultimate bureaucrat, Darth Vader type. They had turned to the cynical side, and they were now in a position to basically stop my redeployment to Iraq. And that person delayed my redeployment.
And saved your life.
And saved my life.
Even though that was not the purpose.
So, yeah, making enemies of incompetent UN bureaucrats can pay off.
Yes, in a big way. In the book, you mention when you were in Iraq, and there's this moment where your boss, Pasha, who was also supposed to be assassinated when the bomb went off outside of your building, but was saved by his smoking habit.
Yeah, I mean, that's... That yeah, he did go for a coffee and a cigar when the bomb blast hit. But there's no way we could have predicted.
No, what but in essence, what it tells you is that smoking can save your life.
Yeah, yeah, just like not putting on your seatbelt in some situations. But yeah, he got lucky. He got very lucky because his own office was right next to the, he would have crumbled in the building.
Yeah.
And he was warned, you know, because of his relationships, he also had some relationships with U.S. authorities. And so the day before he was indicted by the New York District Court, he fled to Cyprus.
Yeah.
So.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Or at least I think. Or well, if you want to delve in. But because... Because you mentioned when you were visiting Iraq and your boss had made a joke, Pasha had made a joke.
Yeah.
Imitating one of the Iraqi ministers that you had a meeting with.
Yeah. Vice president, actually.
All right, yes. Yeah. And your translators couldn't laugh because then they would be killed. But you could tell they tried to laugh. And then you note that the freedom to laugh has never been mentioned in any text of human rights law.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first thing that I discovered when I came up to the Kurdish areas was the freedom is not just a sort of a theocratic thing, you know, a theology or an ideology. It's also a feeling, you know. But this translator knew that if Taha Yassin Ramadan, who was the vice president of Iraq at the time, and greeted us with a Magnum 45. A silver Magnum 45 with an ivory handle at his side and in full military uniform, because it was one of these, during one of these pseudo crises. When he sat down, his gun essentially was pointing towards us. And so when he was looking away, Pasha did a joke like, you know, like him moving his gun and the translator had the urge to giggle a bit like we have in, you know, when we're 12 in sex education class, you know, and we're not allowed to giggle, which makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end, the poor guy basically had to pretend he was crying. And the Iraqi vice president at some point was like, "What's going on with you?" And he was like, "Crying because of the people of Iraq suffering." And I felt so bad for the guy because, you know, who knows what awaits you when you're laughing at something the vice president of Iraq says. He was actually Saddam Hussein's henchman. meaning that when Saddam Hussein, who was bad enough, needed something bad done, like gassing the Kurds, he used Taha Yassin Ramadan.
So not a man you laugh at.
Crocodile eyes, a handshake of a person who's basically afraid of being poisoned by some,
biological agent when someone touches you.
And a very, very dangerous man to piss off, yeah.
So do you think that might be a good idea to include in the UN Charter of Human Rights? The right to laugh?
I think the right to laugh in the face of power is a central element of what keeps our democracies alive. It's included, in a sense, in the Fourth Estate. We call it the press, the free press. And a free press means the First Amendment means the right to poke fun. And that right, currently in America, I mean, the only real news we're getting is from comedy talk shows, late night comedy talk shows, because CNN, which I used to work for, so I don't want to talk badly about them. But the truth is, you turn on CNN for news, and all you get in your face are tweets by Trump and counter tweets and weather reports. And you get 1 second of, oh, by the way, there were, 30 people killed in a Somali attack on whatever. So American people are not getting their news anymore except from these comedy shows. And they sometimes delve into the issues, unlike the news. And so they seem to care more about presenting American problems to American society that need redressing than the news do. So Pulitzer, the famous man who started the Pulitzer Prize, said that the Republic and the press will rise and fall together. I'm afraid right now that there is a situation in the press in America, and which I don't talk about in the book, but which I realized later as I'm studying issues related to corruption. The question is always, what is bad management and what is actual corruption? And I realized that when things are poorly managed, usually there's a reason. And that reason, if you dig far enough, you'll find that money is changing hands in a funny way.
Yes, because you use the same... it was so surprising to me when I read your book, because I just read it now. Mm. And it came out when?
It came out... it came out in 2009, I believe, and had some editions after that.
There's so many weird points of synchronicity between your book and the one I've been writing, but... I use the same trick when I wanted to know what had happened in Sweden during the Second World War as you do in your book when you want to try and explain what happened at the UN. So, to quote you, let's follow the money.
Yeah. Well, that's how they did Watergate, right?
Yes. And and what I found out from your book is that it was not very hard, if you understand banking and international law, to... not a very high degree. The French managed to get one of their banks to manage the proceeds from the Oil for Food program. So it was Banque Nationale de Paris, right?
They were not even graded an A. They didn't even have an A grade.
You don't want an A grade bank for this type of work.
You want a friendly bank in which the majority share was from an arms dealer who lived in Britain under some money protection and had basically been a friend of the Saddam regime and done arms deals
Did the French government own?
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing.
Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A part of this bank as well?
Oh, they used to, and it was privatized. And I believe his name was Ahmed Auchi. He's like a Khashoggi, one of these guys.
What's a Khashoggi?
Khashoggi was maybe the biggest multi-millionaire in the world in the 80s because he was an arms dealer in the Middle East. And he made a lot of the arms deals between people you wouldn't believe that are on opposite sides of conflicts. And this person owned the Banque Nationale de Paris. And in essence, they quickly paid a fine because what they faced, according to the law, was the losses of their banking license in the United States. But they employed the right lobbyists who were able to go and pay the right people on the right committees, and they got away with a fine.
Yep.
And they were able to hold $73 billion worth of cash in their accounts, meaning they could play with that on the markets and make money for themselves the whole time because they had that sure amount of money coming in every month.
So that means the French government had a real interest in seeing the oil for food program continue, right?
Yes.
But they also they wanted to lift the sanctions, or?
Yes, but that was rhetoric. When the U.S. finally invaded Iraq and they said, okay, we can lift the sanctions, it was the Russians in the Security Council who said, well, wait a minute. You said we would lift the sanctions when you found all the weapons of mass destruction. Now, where are the weapons of mass destruction? And so they held it back until their companies had fulfilled their contracts for a while. So it was actually doubly, triply ironic situation. But with the Russians, at least, you know, it's expected that they would game the operation.
They're not a democracy.
Because they're not a democracy. And in the oil industry, anything goes, okay? We all know it. But this was institutionalized. Our job was to avoid this type of corruption. And, I mean, thanks to Saddam Hussein for keeping a list, you know. You want to know who you bribe and who you don't bribe.
And also, you know, that list he thought probably would protect him. Because if, you know, he fell,
yeah,
and that list got out,
yeah,
a lot of people would be implicated, and that's exactly what happened when America went in.
Right. So that's some things that I couldn't write in the book at the time, but that became clear through the person I had been talking with, who was, you know, not someone that I can mention because of security reasons, but the fact that there was a list surprised me. I was like, who would keep a list? But then some of Saddam Hussein's closest upper-rank people got away by sharing the list with the Americans. Only they thought that by sharing the list, the Americans would be happy to see this go public. And it turned out that none of the democracies wanted to see this list go public either. So it was this list of you know, corrupt entities. And again, we're talking about countries, and we're talking about 2,500 international companies. We're talking about Volvo, we're talking about Mercedes, we're talking about Siemens, we're talking about BNP, of course. We're talking about major companies.
I'm pretty sure we didn't see anything in the Swedish press about Volvo being implicated in a corruption scandal at the UN.
I can't remember what their level of implication was, but it may have been minor. I don't know. You would have seen it. Because there would have been a court judgment, but I would have to check on this information. I mean, we need to be clear with our audience that we only speak things we know for sure. But I remember them as being on the list. And in essence, they called in KPMG, which is an independent consulting firm, to verify whether this list had any correlation in reality. And they certified that it was a true list. And at that point, I called the office of Kofi Annan and I told them, I mean, this was the entire reason they hired me in the first place. I had worked in Congress and I could see there were 8 investigations going on in Congress during an election year in the United States against the UN, based on this Oil for Food program fraud that was beginning to emanate in the press. It was first published in an Iraqi newspaper.
Al-Mada.
And then the CIA broke into the headquarters of the person they thought was in possession of the list. Phones started ringing around the globe because...
Shit hit the fan,
essentially. And I could not believe for the life of me that the guy I had worked with, who was incompetent and who was, a real Byzantine type of old UN manager, but who was also funny. He was a bit theatrical, and people grew to like him for reasons that I cannot really understand myself. But he was a personality.
But you liked him.
And even I had no. I mean, I thought he was too incompetent at the end to continue working for, so I quit. But I was really surprised. So I myself wanted to see an investigation conducted because I wanted to know whether I'd spent 3 years working for a completely corrupt system or whether I had worked for one that was merely incompetent. And
are they mutually exclusive, Michael?
Yes. I mean, now you're asking a new question I've never thought about, but they are because corruption is efficient. Whereas mismanagement is inefficient.
Yes.
But corruption is very efficient. It makes money flow and it clarifies deals. So, for example, the Romans, when they would invade Gaul or France, as we call it now, or any other country,
still call it Gaul, but still.
they would have an allocation of 10% for bribes. You bribe the local leaders that don't want to fight and that are ready to join us. You know, you bribe them. It's normal.
Like, yeah.
So the fact that we are closing our eyes to this only makes it worse. And I was an accidental whistleblower in the sense that I wasn't even working there when the act that led to me being called a whistleblower happened. But
no, but as
when I called the office, basically, sorry, when I called the office of Kofi Annan, they said, no, don't worry, it'll blow over. They didn't understand the size of this, and I think Kofi Annan would have had to resign if he didn't do what I suggested to do. I was like, I can't reach him through his own staff. I'm going to write an op-ed that I know he's going to read. And it was published by the Wall Street Journal, and all it did was call for an independent investigation of the program. And then Kofi Annan appointed one of the best investigators in the world who had done the Swiss gold investigation, the Vatican investigation before, and was a former president of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker, who is so old that his middle name is Adolf, and who's so tall that basically he could play basketball at the age of 90, and 6'7" or something. I'm not kidding. The guy was really, really tall.
So, and Adolf Volcker.
Well, Paul was the name he preferred to go with. He had then enormous resources. I think it was about 30 investigators and just about as many $1 million to verify every little detail of this. And it worked very well because our job was not only to seek compliance with the program's aims, which was to help the poor, but we kept records. The UN is good at one thing. It is at keeping records. So they forensically took all of the UN's computers related to the programs and went through every detailed contract, compared it to the KPMG investigation, and then very easily laid out the cases, which were then tried in court in democracies and ignored in tyrannies.
And they were all corrupt, basically.
Yes. It's quite that simple. Yes, unfortunately, I had hoped that it would be a little better than that, but no. It was corrupt. It was a corrupt practice according to our own laws, and so they had broken our own laws that govern corruption, and they had broken the spirit and text of UN Security Council resolutions, which are binding on all nations.
And I know this must have hurt. I thought you had grown up in Denmark, so I wrote a question based on a quote of yours concerning the culture at the UN.
Uh-huh.
The quote is, "The mania of not calling things by their name," end quote. And I thought it must be particularly annoying for you being Danish, since I think you Danes have an expression for that, right? You should call a shovel a shovel.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's many expressions. I discovered that one is based in an old racist slur, which was call a spade, and spade is, of course, we think of it as a shovel, but it was a nickname for a black person. No, in America.
Oh, right. So and, the Dan- in Denmark, it's still a shovel is a shovel. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not a racist slur there. It just, I didn't translate it to spade here because I knew that would be.
No, but in Denmark, of course, provides insulin through the company Novo Nordisk, and they were in on the corruption. The Danish government and the intelligence agencies of Denmark knew everything that was going on. They are, of course, also, when you work for a government, you also have relationships with large companies. And then, of course, you know, when the movie comes out, you get an invitation from Novo Nordisk to speak to their ethical committee so that they may learn from this experience and maybe become better at not being corrupt and et cetera.
But do you think corruption was larger for some countries than others? Because the U.S., Saddam didn't want to pay a kickback to American companies, did he?
No, well, yeah, he did. I mean, Saddam didn't have to do anything he didn't want to do. But he needed to repair some oil fields, and only Halliburton or Cargill or one of these companies knew how to do it because they had done the original. So there was a $300 million deal struck there, which was very, very ironic at the time because basically those two countries were technically at war. And yet they were under sanctions. And so under this UN program, they did, yeah, they transacted, and they transacted just like everybody else by...
But I thought the French wanted most of the contracts.
And they got
the And the American companies tried to set up French front companies or affiliates, and right?
There was some of that. I don't know in those particular cases if they did that, but there was some of that, of course. I mean, and even French companies would set up Lebanese... front companies. And so one day I got a call from a Swiss magistrate asking me, is it legal or not to use front companies under the UN for oil for food program? And I was like, well, let me get back to you. And I called the legal department, where a Russian guy is head of the department. And he says, oh, this is all political. We cannot respond to questions from a magistrate. It has to come through the official channels. And so I was like, I read the text myself.
And this was from the legal department at the UN.
Yeah, yeah. But when you put a Russian career bureaucrat as head of the legal department, you're going to get the legal advice that you get. And... his name was Vladimir Golitsyn. I checked myself what the rules were governing the program. Very thick documents with all sorts of, fine print. And it was not legal. And so I took it on myself to just call back that magistrate in Switzerland and say, no, it's not legal. And they say, well, can you put it on paper for us? And I'm like, no, I can't get anyone to sign it. And they were like, what is the problem? And then I was the one who was, I felt
incompetent. So what was the problem? Why wouldn't anyone sign a document that merely stated what was official UN policy that they could find basically online, right?
Yeah. Because the UN works for the member states, right? So unless it comes through an embassy, it's true. The guy had a point. They had to make their request. Otherwise, we would be answerable to every single person or whatever in the world. But why can't the UN reply to an obvious question like that? And that is because if you work at the UN beyond a certain level, and that's maybe the level right above the one where I was, you are answerable to one or more member states if you want your career to continue, which means you report or you help them in situations like this. So a Russian working for the UN, it's inconceivable that they wouldn't report whatever issue there is or help them out. But same for many democratic countries. You have people regularly reporting to their own intelligence services about what goes on at the UN.
That much was very clear from your book.
Yeah, yeah.
But also the second rule of making a career at the UN, which is make sure that the buck doesn't stop with you, right?
Ah, yeah, that's an important rule. And it's
why is it important?
Well, because taking responsibility means taking action. And the last thing a bureaucrat wants to do is to take action. Because if you take action, people notice you. And they see you as a free operator and someone who's capable of actually making a decision and taking action is not somebody they want in the bureaucracy at the United Nations. Why? It's because it messes with the incompetence, which is essentially enshrined in the UN Charter. And that incompetence is ensured by the fact that we have created a club in which not all members are required to play by the rules. We have allowed, not even a bridge club could function like that, right? So we should not be surprised that the UN is sometimes corrupt or sometimes mismanaged. We should be surprised when it is doing good things and when it is not mismanaged.
But we're paying quite a lot for this.
Well, and in Sweden you are, yeah.
Yeah, and the guys working for it are not taxed on their salaries,
yeah.
And they have diplomatic immunity.
Oh, yeah, it was so nice. I never had to check my bank account.
No, I can imagine. But, with diplomatic immunity, in essence, you don't even have to take responsibility.
No. Responsibility is like something that goes around and around and around. And we spoke of Srebrenica earlier, and I once heard a UN bureaucrat who was in charge of Yugoslavia. At the time, I was writing my thesis for my master's, and I interviewed a number of people, including the general, General Morillon, who was in charge and trying to call the UN to get orders to fire back to protect the people whom the Serbians were about to kill, and got no response. But yeah, the buck stops nowhere. So typically what you do when you get a memo calling for action is you slap a yellow sticker on it and you pass it on to another department and ask for advice. And if they are smart, they'll quickly slap a yellow sticker on it and send it right back to you telling you we think you are authorized to take your own advice, and then you can send it to the Office of Legal Affairs, because then you're absolutely sure that it'll take a month before you get anything back. And
by then, the time for decision is over.
Is over.
Yes. Yeah, it was beautifully put. But the rule of handling the internal workings of the UN that I liked the most was your number one rule: the truth is not a matter of fact.
Right.
It is a product of consensus.
Yes. In that world, that is true. In the real world, the truth is the truth.
Except in Sweden, it's not. It's a product of consensus. That's why...
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Definitely.
In Denmark, you can also say that because of our culture. In Scandinavia in general, we have a high level of political correctness, which of course makes it an ideal ground for comedy, because... political correctness is also a way to institute not tyranny, but totalitarianism of thinking. Once you're being shunned for stepping outside a certain zone, and once that zone becomes so big as to encompass basic, huge questions of politics, then you have created a society in which, without humor, you're basically left with: do I want to pick an argument, or do I want to have a chill dinner with my friends? And if you're not politically, if you just want to live a normal life and be happy, then you don't pick arguments and you stay politically correct.
How can you have a chill dinner with your friends if they're too afraid to laugh?
Well, then you have to pick your friends well.
I guess you do. One of the other points of weird synchronicity between your book and mine is a quote you use at the beginning of a chapter, which is, mm-hmm. quote, "resistance is futile, you will be assimilated," end quote. You're quoting the Borg from Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yes. I've actually been described in interviews questioned in interviews how I would describe Swedes. and that's the quote I use.
Well, I mean, I was very afraid when I first started at the UN of becoming part of a bad system. Because I had written my thesis about the former Yugoslavia, where so many things went wrong. But I also knew that there are, a lot of kids in Africa who wouldn't be alive today if UNICEF had not come in with food and if the World Food Program had not been there to deliver it. And
you mean Angelina Jolie?
Yeah. I mean, actually, she is more competent to run the UN than any of these secretary generals. She knows more about what it is to be in a refugee camp. She's actually visited some than these bureaucrats do. And if you've been in movie production, you understand action a lot better than you do in a UN bureaucracy. But I think, yeah, you get assimilated because of that, precisely because of that quote, which is the truth is not a matter of fact. It is a matter of consensus. So when you start out, people think it's kind of funny to have a young guy around who asks questions that are kind of taboo. Everybody knows not to ask this because they know that the truth is, you know, that the Office of Human Resources, for example, does not reward people based on, good results, because results cannot be measured in a bureaucracy. They reward people based on ageism, in essence. And so when you wonder about these things, then people don't answer, and they kind of smile behind your back or sometimes in front of you, and you're like, you know, cute kid.
Yeah.
And the fact is, I was becoming less and less of a cute kid, and I was taking on responsibility at a rate that was unusual at the UN, because people normally duck responsibility. So at the end of a meeting, when they were like, okay, so who takes this, who takes that, and who takes this? And so when nobody raised their hands, I would basically be like, okay, let's do it. You know, I
you really tried.
Dumb as it may sound today, I believed in the mission. I did believe that if we're going to keep that country under sanctions and under Saddam, it was our responsibility to make sure they got food, medicines, and, you know, electricity and things like that. And that it was our mission to make sure that people who are already rich are not stealing from these people, some of whom were among the most destitute on the planet. Talk about the Iraqi Shia population in the south, not having clean water in temperatures of over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, or electricity. Is cholera started spreading, old diseases that basically we hadn't heard of since World War I spread and killed. Counting in the millions is not a crazy thing to do when you're talking about the number of Iraqi children died. But there was, of course, a whole propaganda machine also that used this as a way to lift sanctions in a way that would be unconditional, which basically meant that Saddam would be free to use the money to buy tanks. And that would not help necessarily feed the Iraqi people more. He would just feed his cronies and leave the others to feed themselves. But anytime you impose sanctions on a country, you're going to enable illegal transfers of goods, smugglers. Right? And there are entire countries that basically have only one method of revenue, which is smuggling. Afghanistan is one, for example. The north of Iran, a lot of the Kurdish areas, without smuggling, they can't really, they don't have a business model. So we have to be very, very intelligent when we impose sanctions. And our type of sanctions used to be called smart sanctions. And I say this making quotes with my hands, because of course they were so smart that some very rich people were able to enrich themselves even more on the back of the people who were trying to help. And it makes you want to vomit, you know,
when on the back and sometimes the corpses.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, what is wrong with France? I'm asking.
Apart from the French, you mean?
That would be the obvious answer, but because I was wondering, because you're recounting in the book, this power struggle between Paul and de Villepin. Is that how you pronounce
yeah,
it?
Yeah, de Villepin, yes, I guess.
Yeah. And he was born in Morocco, like your father.
Oh, he was?
Yes, he was.
Oh, he was Pied Noir, I think, maybe from Tangiers. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That was a very international sort of island.
The reason I'm asking is because they seem to be one of the main, or at least they seem to me to be the main culprit from the Western sphere of influence in the scandal at the UN. They had already sold Saddam Hussein a nuclear reactor back in the early 80s, right? The Osirak that the Israelis bombed.
Yeah.
And had they not bombed it, Saddam Hussein would have had nukes.
Oh, yeah. By 86 or 87, full capacity.
So good on Israel for bombing.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, what the Iraqis said was when they were building it, they were in the middle of a war with Iran. And they said, don't worry, Iran, we're not building it for you. We're building it to attack Israel. So it was quite clear what the threat was. And
they wanted to nuke Israel, basically.
Yeah, and the capacity of this, or at least have the threat to nuke them, which then allows you to do quite a few things. But yeah, the Osirak reactor was basically almost ready to start enriching uranium at a pretty, I mean, this was higher technology than even the Iranians have now, in some respects. This was a turnkey sale, which enriched people on a scale not even
in France.
Yeah.
And then when the sanctions set in, they continually wanted to lift the sanctions, although they didn't want to lift the sanctions because they still wanted to take kickbacks from the sales, right?
You could say there are several powers of interest in France, and there were those who act behind the scenes, and there's those who act in front of the cameras. And so to say France as one unit is very, very difficult because both political parties have their own intelligence communities.
Oh, really?
Yes. Which
so the conservative and the socialists.
Yes.
Because those are the sides in France.
Well, they go to Africa and come back with suitcases of cash that finance their political campaigns. Okay, this is like a very, very well-known thing, but it has to be repeated sometimes.
So why France? What's wrong with them?
What's wrong with France? My God, that's a big question. Well, for one, I think they're partially dehydrated. all this coffee and, from the morning, and then they go straight to wine. And I think their level of hydration is too low. And they're a bit like Italians in a bad mood, like Italians put like in a...
Yes, but Italians just yell. They're not going to beat you up.
Yeah, no, it's not serious. The French really are pissed off. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that there is an elite in France that rules the country, no matter who you vote for. And that's why I think it's very dangerous, because France is the next candidate in Europe for a right-wing government. And when I say right-wing in France, it's very different from right-wing in Scandinavia. What we would call the moderate right wings of Scandinavia. Right wing in France is Vichy, right? These people now account for a third of the electorate, and they're, after 1 year of Macron...
And they are Vichy because the French never really dealt with the Vichy culprits after the war, or...?
Well, eventually they did, credit has to be given where credit is due, and Jacques Chirac recognized the role of France in deporting and killing Jews. And he did so very publicly, and it was, you got to give credit where credit is due. But it took that long. What the consensus was in France was that France had been liberated by the French, even though they, constituted very few of the actual people that died on the beaches of Normandy. You know, when I was young, my father took me to the beaches of Normandy. I didn't know what was going on. I was 10 years old, and he took me to this enormous cemetery. And
where all the white crosses are.
Yeah, you have rows and rows of white crosses spanning further than the eyes can see. And he said, you see all these people? I said, yeah, well, there's a lot of dead people. And he said, well, they died so that you could be free. And at 10 years old, I don't know that I really fully understood what freedom meant. So I asked my dad, well, what's freedom? You know, essentially he said, well, I'm a journalist. I'm allowed to work and to tell it as it is because we live in a free country.
Even though you were in France at the time.
Yeah. And the French press, I mean, was when we first moved there, my father had to submit questions in advance in order to interview the president, for example. And he would then do his own questions anyway, and then next, no more interviewing public officials. We went to cover some, big demonstrations after an oil spill in Normandy, for example. And it wasn't even on the news, in the French news. But all of Brittany knew about it because there had been a blast at a nuclear plant. It was not in the French news. So there was essentially censorship until and during the Mitterrand era. And then there was self-censorship, which in France is a funny thing. Everybody knew that Mitterrand had various affairs and that one of his daughters was living illegitimately in the Élysée Palace with him and the former wife and all that. Unimaginable in a Puritan country like France, and from a taxpayer money, unimaginable in Scandinavia. But very sort of okay in France. But so what's wrong with the French? I think there's many things that are right with the French. The French gave us, a huge impetus for the ideology that stands behind democracy. But we have to remember one thing when we talk about democracy and tyranny. It's a struggle, and it's a bloody struggle. And that's why I go back to the beaches of Normandy. Unfortunately, the way democracy has spread throughout Europe, if we look at the 2,000-year span between the Declaration of Independence here and the Declaration of Human Rights in France, the spread of democracy has involved a number of huge European wars in which more people died than in all of the Middle East's conflicts combined times, a million. You know, we're looking at 50 to 70 million people dying during World War II, including Russia, including, every front. So democracy spreads in the world only violently, because dictators never give up power without a fight.
And it doesn't help to pay them off.
That's what we've been doing.
Yeah.
We've been paying them off to do our bidding,
yeah,
but not to help their own citizens, who then become extremists and who become a problem for us when they show up in our subways and convince young people to blow themselves up. You know, back in Denmark, we have to go through White House security just to get into Politiken, which is a newspaper.
Yeah.
In France, every synagogue, there are cops in front of the synagogue and plainclothes security guards that have to be employed. You can't even go to a kosher butchery, and ironically, that's where most Muslims buy their meat in Paris, without seeing police and special guards, because they were attacked with Kalashnikovs. I don't know if you've ever seen the efficiency of a Kalashnikov in an attack on civilians, but it is nothing like a gun or even these AR-15s they have here. It is the most efficient killing machine. They're big bullets. They really kill people. They don't maim them. If you've been hit by a Kalashnikov, your chances of survival are much less than if you've been hit by any other rifle. So we're dealing with a very insecure Europe, within which France, I don't think, is playing a negative role overall. France believes in Europe. France believes in certain values, at least on open mic.
There's a difference between principle and practice.
Yes, but at least they figured out the principle part. And you know the French. If something works in practice, you still have to see if it works in principle. that's the basis of their math. But what's wrong with the French? I don't know. There's so much that's good about them that I hesitate to make a...
You grew up in the country.
A generalization. But I am more Danish in my values than I am French. I have only experienced France as a rather corrupt system where the well-to-do are connected and can get their kids into the right places. And when the ones who are not are essentially screwed by the system unless they organize. And the problem, of course, then is that the syndicates in France, as we see now, you can't move, there's no train running and all of that, are not organized in a way that makes dialogue very productive. They're organized in a way that where the only way to really end a strike is to pay off the leader of the syndicate, because they can paralyze a country.
Yes.
And so when it's gone on for too long, you know, the practice is, as I understand it, that money gets transferred to these.
Well, that only works as long as the elite has money.
Yeah, I mean, but these syndicates, I mean, these syndicates, I call them syndicates, which here is a criminal connotation, but...
You mean unions.
Guilds and unions, yeah. They have a war chest, which allows them to go on strike. But in Scandinavia, they are required to reach agreement. Otherwise, the government steps in and acts as the final authority. And if the people don't agree with it, they're fine. I mean, that's it. So there is no impetus to reach agreement in France. There's a huge impetus to create conflict. Because when one party is in power, the other party has every reason to finance the continuation of strikes against the party that's in power. So that's one of the things that's wrong with France. But internationally speaking, France has been, with Britain and with all the permanent five members of the Security Council, the biggest sellers of arms in the world. So the Security Council was created with the mission of maintaining peace in the world. And the five top permanent members of the Security Council, Russia, China, France, and the United Kingdom, are the biggest traders of weapons in the world. With these two facts alone, I think we've understood the problem.
Yes, I would say we have. Oh, right. So... you got one piece of advice from a guy called Trevor in the book,
mm-hmm.
also spooky, because he was probably a spy for the British, or could have been. At least that was his nickname at the UN.
You can be a spy even if everybody knows you're one.
I'm sure, but aren't they called diplomats?
That's what they're called.
So he gave you a piece of he gave you a piece of advice when you started, and I was hoping you could give that piece of advice to me and my listener.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was pulling a prank on me, because he took me aside 1 week after I was hired at the UN. My boss was fired, and the boss of my boss arrived and decided to take me with him to Iraq. So I'm traveling to Iraq with an undersecretary general, which is as high as it gets below the secretary general. And this senior UN bureaucrat was also the chief of all these blue UN guards. So he had two jobs in one. Imagine how many people are able to do two jobs in one and be expected to. But Trevor took me aside and said, listen, you're going to come under a lot of pressure. I know for a fact that the Iraqis have visited your apartment. I'm really there a bit naive, because I'm really thinking these things are impossible and that. But basically, the reason I was hired by this Ethiopian guy called Johannes Mengesha, who was really a nice guy, is because he needed someone to write English, because everybody else wrote volapük, as we call it in Danish.
And what does that mean? Just
it just means a language that is indecipherable for a normal person, and even for a diplomat. And so writing grammatically correct English is a rare skill, in fact. And he said, people are wondering, you know, how a 24-year-old guy who says he's French, but is also from Denmark, and is also from, he had done his research on me, and gets hired. And he was pretty sure that I was in it for the French. But he was prying, he was asking, he was whatever. And when he finally realized that I was a complete amateur, or at least he realized that it was a possibility that I was a complete amateur, which I was, he gave me a piece of advice. And that was, you know, there's the anti-sanction people, there's the pro-sanction people, and there's the people of us that are trying to make the program work. And he was one of them. And he says, in making the decisions, you have to be your own man. Meaning that you can't just go along with whatever is decided in a meeting of people who are afraid to make decisions, as we spoke about earlier. That you have to listen to your own principles. And Spooky, of course, hoped that these principles would be pro-Western in the sense of this being a conflict between Iraq and the West. And as it turned out, I also thought I was pro-Western until I realized that it wasn't, you know, that simple. But who else are you supposed to be pro? And the truth is, you're not supposed to be pro anything else than what you believe in. And that can only be rooted in value and facts. And so, I value that piece of advice. I put it at the beginning of the book, not only because it happened at the beginning of the story, but because in the end, when I made the decision to resign and when I made a decision to speak out and to go public with you know information that had come out, I was being my own person. But it is far easier in life to just comply with whatever is the truth of the day.
The consensus.
You will probably have a more stable life where you don't have to rely on yourself to be entertaining or insightful or, you know, you're fighting upriver, you're going against the system. And every system needs jesters, right? Even the King of France needed a jester in the system, in the court, for the court to be a fun place to be and not just like a, you know, a depressing environment. Playing that role, though, means that you have to, of course, doubt everything and until proven, you know,
correct.
And so, it's our job in a sense to try to be our own man or woman on this planet. When we are writers, I used to teach writing at New York University, and I said to the students there, I'm going to give you some tools that are going to allow you to persuade people very, very effectively. But I cannot give those tools to you as a writer if you're going to use them for wrong or to spread lies. Of course, I can't check, but it is true that narratives, stories, are what makes the world go round. And so when we speak about the consensus versus the truth being based on fact, we are in fact talking about a world that is made to go round to profit those who are able to distribute, display, build this narrative. And it takes quite a few resources, not only to conduct the surveys necessary to figure out how your narrative is going to play to certain populations, but to figure out how and when to distribute it, online or otherwise. And it takes money to bribe journalists, because journalists are bribed in our world, in democracies. I've seen it happen at an age that was even before I joined the UN, so you can imagine what I was hoping for. But it goes full circle. But stories are maybe the operating system of the human body. That's how we understand our reality. And so the truth now can only come from comedy shows or drama shows that we see on Netflix that take on things like the pharmaceutical complex or things that we can't really speak about in the press. Why? Because you open Time magazine and you see a huge advertisement for Boeing. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't have enough money to buy a Boeing airplane. So what is Boeing doing advertising in Time magazine? One explanation is that their image as a company deserves to be advertised for name recognition. As if we choose a Boeing or an Airbus to go from France to, New York. We don't know which plane that cheap airline
is going to give us. We just show up and hope it has wings.
Try to stick in and, we hope it has wings. But the reason they place these ads, and the reason the pharmaceutical industry places these ads, and the reason many companies that have subsidiaries that are involved in, financing wars and things like that, place ads. They are in order to prevent the editors of the news division from making choices that would be in the best interest of the reader's information. So a good editor is supposed to be able to sift through the news and see what is most important for our readership to know in order to function as good citizens in a democracy. That's why Pulitzer said the democracy and its press will rise and fall together. Today we have major media companies that are bought by a surplus of advertising that basically means that if they do a certain report that pisses off somebody at a large company or the interests of a large company, it's okay, it'll run. But the next year, will that editor still have a job? And before that, will that reporter be reassigned to a place to have a blog somewhere and then slowly, yes. So we're looking at the reason why we still go on CNN on our phone, right, to see what the news is. And all we get is ads for things we said the other day about, oh, my neck hurts, so we get an ad about a neck medicine, okay? But essentially, yeah, the news is bought and paid for. Occasionally, in the opinions column, one gets to argue. But even then, when I wanted to blow the whistle on the UN, I went to the New York Times first, and they wouldn't run an anti-UN piece because it was not in the interest of the Democratic Party, which they were, following their platform. And so you have to know the game. And having worked at CNN, having worked on Capitol Hill, and having worked in the field as a journalist, I understood that, okay, this had to run in the Wall Street. The only people that would run this and that would be big enough would be the Wall Street Journal. Because it was in their interest to run it.
Because they were on the conservative.
Because they were on the conservative side.
Yeah.
And so by extension, I found myself in the Fox News headquarters, and they were like, are you ready to go on camera saying Kofi Annan knew? And I'm like, I'm ready to go on camera saying you knew, but also saying, ask him for yourself, because I was a journalist and I know what they do to whistleblowers. They lionize them when it suits them, and then they shove them to the side and basically
freeze them out.
They freeze them out and they portray them as self-interested people who are trying to advance their own ego or something. But the truth is, it's never people over 35 who are whistleblowers. Very rarely. It's young people. It's usually young, eager, competent people between the ages of 25 and 35 who find something wrong in the course of very important work, because very important work is assigned to people that are young enough to take responsibility. And this includes all bureaucracies, including at the Pentagon, including in places we wouldn't think. Young people get a lot of responsibility. Edward Snowden, whom they called a hacker, was a fully trained digital spy. Look where he ended up, the gulag.
Yes.
He was a whistleblower, but he knew that he would have to sacrifice his own life or liberty.
Country.
And citizenship and freedom in order to tell his country some truths, which somehow, despite what is supposed to be a free press, has not even registered with us. And so now we're reaching the second phase of the digital revolution, where privacy is basically a thing of the past. And without privacy, the founders of this country understood that without privacy, you can't have democracy. And yet, Silicon Valley, they all met with Trump when he was first elected, even though they disliked him extreme, the extreme. I mean, they came from San Francisco to meet. And shortly later, a law was passed that basically allows any company that has any of your information to sell it for profit online. So even a hospital, if they send your information to another hospital that's bound by medical rules of privacy, they can use a company in the middle that is providing a service of transmission, and that company can sell anything they want down the river. So we're really talking about us here and now being subject to conditions that lead us naturally towards an erosion of our democratic, not only our rights and our freedoms, but our entire ideology is under attack. We no longer know what exactly it means to live in a democracy. If we are in fact in a kleptocracy or in an oligarchy, when it comes down to, you know, who's able to pay for what. I don't think the Russians have a lot on us when it comes to oligarchies, for example. And we might as well, you know, the truth has this power that once it's said, it's been said and you can't take it back, and it's out there. The problem is that the ramification of the digital revolution, and I know we're probably running a bit long, you're probably going to have to do some editing on this, but, you know, when new modes of communication become available, when, for example, film propaganda and radio became available, who were the best at using it? The Nazis, right? We were quite late on it, and the Americans made use of the best directors in Hollywood to come and make propaganda films for the war effort. So they understood the power of it about 5 years, I would say 10 years after the Germans, mid-30s, really understood the power of it.
You mean after they had imported Leni Riefenstahl here to America, where she could start doing commercials
with
cigarette companies?
Yeah, I mean, that was essentially that's when you're talking to the professionals. But even to the layman, we understand that new digital internet means of communication present an opportunity to communicate differently. Now, have the forces of democracy, if they exist anywhere, and if they are organized anywhere, and if they know what they're doing, made use of this new extremely powerful mode of communication, which has attracted, you know, thousands of people to ISIS from Western European countries through internet indoctrination, which has been very easy to do for them through chat rooms and etc. Are we understanding that this changing modes of communication, we've seen now through Cambridge Analytica that another major global superpower was able to, you know, use these private enterprises to offer information otherwise not available to, well, at the time not available to the Democrats in sufficient ways, to target their electoral, strategy. Are we then living in a free country, in a democracy? We have to ask ourselves the question every day, and we have to ask ourselves the question, where are the kinks in the system? Why isn't the press reporting anything about, you know, the global oil industry's practices, which we know from, I mean, I learned about through this experience. This happens every day. What I discovered through the investigation that was made was basically a global map of how corruption works. But it continues to work that way and has always worked that way. And it's the 10 or 20% rule.
Well, you'll be glad to hear that this show is completely financed through micro donations. I don't even know who's giving me money.
It's okay. I'll slip it under the table. more can be put in an envelope than I imagined, actually.
All right.
That's one of the things I discovered.
Well, isn't that just a question of how big the envelope is?
or how big the bills are that you put in the envelope. But
that also.
Yeah, envelopes continue to be the best form of transaction for corrupt transactions. Envelopes and suitcases and diplomatic pouches of cash.
Well, it's been fascinating to talk to you. It has been. And I think I got a crash course in international diplomacy just from reading your book and sitting across from you. So thank you so much for coming to Deconstructive Criticism, Michael Susan.
I hope we have deconstructed a few things for your listeners.
Well, it has been packed with information, so they'll have to listen at least twice.
Let's make them.
Thank you for having listened to Deconstructive Criticism with this episode's guest, Michael Susan. You can find Backstabbing for Beginners where books are sold, and if you're unsure as to where that is, you will find the link on my webpage, aronflam.com. A big thank you for supporting Deconstructive Criticism, whether it be on Patreon, via PayPal, Bitcoin, or Swish 0768-943737, 0768-943737. All ways to contribute can be found in the description of this episode, regardless of what platform you're listening on. You will also find a link to my webpage, aronflam.com, where you can buy t-shirts, mugs, and hoodies with this podcast's motto, "Your feelings are hurting my thoughts," as well as t-shirts and mugs with a text, "Crush socialism, socialism is evil," and then signed with a little heart afterwards, just to remind you that we crush ideologies and not people. As well as my own book, This is a Swedish Tiger. Second edition is now sold out. The third edition will be going to print next week, and when it comes out, it will contain 3 new chapters. I am very proud of this third edition. Thanks to you who bought a copy of the first and or second editions. Your support enables me to, for instance, fly to Los Angeles to conduct the series of interviews that you can now listen to on Deconstructive Criticism's feed. Among them, the interview you've just heard with Michael Susan. Regarding the book tour and the Gothenburg event being deplatformed, we have now found an alternate venue at Folkets Hus in Backa. Event details can be found on Facebook, and links to that and other events can be found on aronflam.com. You've listened to Deconstructive Criticism. I am Aron Flam. Till next you hear from me, have a good unit of time.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.